This is a replay of the Thursday night, March 7th WGN show. We started right at 10. If you don't hear yourself on it, it's because you didn't call. I hope you'll rectify that soon. We're live Monday through Thursday evenings, and unless sports preempt us, that's from 10 to 1 Central. Dial 888-876-5593. My toll-free number from OneVoip for the world's best customer service. It's OneVoip. Check them out at the number 1-VOIP.com. You'll be really glad you did. So welcome to Denizens of the Stream. You missed the opening of D.B. Cooper, and you can catch up. I'll get you there. But as far as the start of it, of course, it's well known, the incident in November of 1971. And if not, you can read about it. All right. Sorry. I know. John just told me you forgot to hit start on the stream, which, of course, starts the recorder. So the playback is lacking for the first 15 minutes or so. So what we'll do is leave it there for a moment, and we'll pick up what some of the suspects were over the years. And also, and by the way, seven people have confessed to being D.B. Cooper. Not any reason to believe that they were, but there is a new slew of suspects. Yeah, including Milton Vordal, like I say, whose granddaughter is on a podcast as I speak. So we'll pick it up right there. And then after I go through all of this, we'll take your calls. But I wanted to get through all of this because, as I say, I was practically getting threatened in email because it's been so many days where I said, and we'll discuss D.B. Cooper. And we didn't, but we will tonight. So all that coming up on WGN Radio.
Did you say goodbye to me? Now I'm as lonely as could be. And as I feel a teardrop fall, I hear your footsteps down the hall, walking away from me. Why did you say goodbye? Why did you make me cry? Now every day I wonder why, oh why, oh, footsteps, 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 footsteps.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. So you're saying, why are you playing Steve Lawrence? Well, if you haven't heard, he passed away. And John said, you're going to play at least a few records. I said, yeah, I probably could come up with a few. Footsteps, when he was absolutely in his prime, died 88 years old, Alzheimer's. And so Edie, I think, died almost a decade ago now, I think. And she was about 7 years older than him. So rest in peace, Steve Lawrence. And yes, you will hear a little more of him coming up. All right, so we'll pick it up with D.B. Cooper. And as I say, seven people confessed. The first one actually wasn't the individual himself. It was his son. This is Rick McCoy. You might have heard about him in passing if you've been keeping up with the D.B. Cooper stories. And actually, he's rather well known because there was a copycat hijacking a couple years later with one Richard F. McCoy doing this. The only difference was he got caught that time. And he was sentenced to 45 years in prison, but he escaped after 2 years and then was killed in 1974 in a shootout with cops in Virginia. But his son, Rick, has provided DNA evidence and says that his mother confessed, his mother, Karen McCoy, that she was the accomplice. And she revealed to her children she assisted in orchestrating not just the most notorious skyjacking in history, i.e. D.B. Cooper, but the additional one that in fact got him incarcerated and subsequently killed. And she says she helped him plan both of his heists. Well, she didn't do too well on the second one. All right, so we'll pick it up right there with more confessors. Yeah, there were at least seven who stood up and said, oh, that's me, Jack Kohlfelt, next, coming up on WGN Radio.
Thought I was in love before, and then you moved in next door. Pretty blue eyes, pretty blue eyes. All the guys from the neighborhood keep saying you sure look good with your blue eyes,
pretty blue eyes. Saw you from my window, my heart skipped a beat. Gonna sit by your doorstep so that I can meet. Pretty blue eyes, please come out today so I can tell you what I have to say, that I love you. Love you, pretty blue eyes.
WGN Radio, I'm Ronnie James. Boy, the early 60s, that was Steve and Edie's time. I'll tell you what, so many records on Columbia and hits, too, like Pretty Blue Eyes. Indeed. So, rest in peace, Steve Lawrence, 88 years old, Alzheimer's. So, as I say, it's been quite a few years now since Edie passed. All right, so we're getting to the seven people who confessed to being D.B. Cooper, or at least their relatives confessed for him. So we mentioned the deal about Rick McCoy, who we know was a hijacker because he was absolutely arrested for it. But did he, 2 years before that, successfully do the jump northwest? Who knows? Now, other confessors, we have six more who have publicly come out, and all of them are just unlikely, but I'll go over it anyway. Jack Kofelt was one of them, and he was a swindler all the way around and a con artist and all that. And he was in jail, as you'd expect, in 1972, and he reached out to a former cellmate, James Brown, not the godfather of soul, saying that he was D.B. Cooper. And he urged Brown to pursue a movie deal for himself on this. He claimed that he landed near Mount Hood, injured himself, and lost the money in the process. He then burned his parachute with magnesium powder and fled in a jeep he had stashed nearby. And bottom line to that is everybody believes he was just trying to pull another con. Then there was Dwayne Weber. And he harbored secrets, no doubt about that, but probably not this one. He was a World War II vet, had a post-war record of incarceration for, over 20 years, forgery, burglary, and more than a few skeletons in his closet. But he didn't come to light until his wife, Jo Weber, heard her husband's deathbed confession. He says, "Come here, come closer." His wife says, "He wanted me about 2 feet from his face." He says, "I have a secret to tell you." "What?" He says, "I'm Dan Cooper." Well, that didn't mean a thing to her because she didn't know who Dan Cooper was, right? But over time, she put it together. The problem with his confession is if he claimed to have left fingerprints on the plane during the heist, they weren't his own because they weren't found. Now, the next one I find most fascinating, clearly not real, but a lot of fun, and that was Barbara Dayton. That's right. That's right. D.B. Cooper is a woman. Well, formerly a woman. She said that 2 years after going a gender reassignment surgery, she boarded a plane while presenting as a male, altered her voice, and carried out the greatest unsolved aviation heist ever. And she was ticked off because she had been denied a commercial pilot license, and she sought revenge on the airline industry, and she claimed she had hidden all the stolen money in a cistern in Woodburn. And she was busy talking to everybody until it was pointed out to her that the government was still ready, willing, and able to prosecute whoever actually committed the hijacking. Then she said, "Nope, I made it all up." All right, so I'll leave it to you, but I don't buy it. There was William Pratt Gossett, and here again, it's a son nominating him. Yeah, because when his son turned 21, he gave him the keys to a safe deposit box in Vancouver that he claimed was full of money stolen during the plane hijacking. Now, the problem with this story is no one's actually found the locker or the money. But Greg Gossett, his son, claimed that his father showed him two keys for a safe deposit box, claiming that within the box was the money from the D.B. Cooper heist, which he had committed. And he made me, the son says, he made me swear I wouldn't tell anybody until after he died. And his brother Kirk also claimed that he heard the story several times as well, saying, "You know, Dad had a kind of temperament to do something like this." But the FBI needs a little more evidence, and they don't have any on that as far as that goes. Then there's Walter Recca. Walter Recca was interesting as far as that goes. He's a former paratrooper, and he specifically described exactly how he pulled off the heist. And, you know, he's got it even on tape. A friend of his released it to the public via the Daily Mail. And he the guy who, his friend, claimed he had additional evidence beyond the audio recording that he possessed documents detailing how a large portion of the $200,000 heist money was used and all of that. And so Lauren, his friend, Carl Lauren, swore that, yeah, it was Recca. He was a high-level covert intelligence operative for various governments. There's a couple problems with this. Firstly, in his version of events, he claimed he landed in Cle Elum, where he went to a roadside diner, and he asked a dump truck driver to give his friend's direction over the phone to the diner. Well, decades after the encounter, his friend Lauren found the truck driver, who did recall a man at the diner requesting that he provide directions to someone else over the phone, but the man did not resemble D.B. Cooper in any way, and that's why supposedly the dump truck driver never put it together. But more than that is the fact that there are inconsistencies in his story completely. So the most thorough and detailed confession, but it doesn't add up. Then there's Robert Rackstraw. Well, yeah, you can rule him out too, although it's a name you hear a lot. And he was claiming he did it. He also, by the way, was suspected of kiting checks and put in jail in 1977. But he claimed, of course, that he was in depositions and stuff, that he was a Vietnam vet. And then he left for Iran in the late 70s to teach the Shah's men how to fly helicopters, pre-revolution, I suppose. Eventually, he was extradited back to the U.S. for unrelated crimes. And what had happened was authorities were looking into him and discovered about 150 pounds of dynamite and 14 rifles in his storage unit, so they got him back. He was arrested for allegedly murdering a stepfather, though he was acquitted of that. He faked his own death, which is always handy, pretending to crash a plane into Monterey Bay, which he didn't. You know, this will get you out of everything from debts to child support. Well, in any case, he was never formally linked to the case by anyone in law enforcement, as far as that goes, but there was an amateur investigator, Tom Colbert, who went to great efforts to prove he was the one. And it was Colbert who pressured the FBI to release the files in a FOIA request and all of that stuff. And the problem, as far as I know, were not only inconsistencies, but I'm not sure. I think that that his past turned out to be also invented. He passed away in 2019. He firmly denied it was him to the end. All right, so that's some. Now, we got more. Oh, yes, but wait, there's more. Oh, there's plenty more. Dick Briggs, he was a cocaine dealer, and he claimed that oh, it's so bizarre. I don't even know how to boil this one down. A friend of his said, Dick Briggs was the real culprit. He not only told me about it, but at a party, he told a hippie-looking couple that they were both later find some of the money. And sure enough, days later, they found money, about $7,000 worth of stolen cash while at a beach. The problem is it's not necessarily the same stolen cash. The serial numbers didn't match up. And he was ruled out completely because he falsified his involvement in the Vietnam War, along with his ability to parachute. He died in a car accident in Portland in 1980, 41 years old, so it wasn't him. Yeah, Richard McCoy, as I mentioned, he was interesting by virtue of what his son said. There was Dwayne Weber, as I mentioned, him as well, who deathbed confession. Then there was Sheridan Peterson, who died at 94 a couple years ago. Never confessed to being D.B. Cooper, but often noted the FBI had good reason to suspect him. And apparently he enjoyed the notoriety and was on television a lot and all that. And his past in the Marine Corps and work with Boeing made Eric Ullis, 98, convinced it was him. Now, Eric Ullis, if you don't know the name, then you're obviously not involved with the D.B. Cooper groups, because he is probably the best-known researcher into D.B. Cooper and who it might be. And apparently Sheridan Peterson had an unassuming life, but made no secret of his adrenaline-filled adventures. But for the most part, probably not. All right, so now we talked about who's not. Now, there's a couple things that are interesting that have come out. I mentioned this tie, and it's the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, the parachute was great as far as that goes, and especially with the sudden denial of taking a look at it, people are wondering, yeah, is the FBI stopping it or whatever? But the tie is even better. It really is. I'll tell you all about the tie. It was a clip-on from JCPenney. Dan Cooper should be embarrassed, whoever he is. We'll tell you all about it, what was on it, and who suspected, coming up on WGN Radio.
Go away, little girl. Go away, little girl. I'm not supposed to be alone with you. I know that your lips are sweet, but our lips must never meet. I belong to someone else, and I must be true. Oh, go away, little girl. Go away, little girl. It's hurting me more each minute that you delay. When you are near me like this, you're much too hard to resist. So go away, little girl, before I beg you to stay. Don't stay. It'll never work out when you are near me like this. You're much too hard to resist. So go away, little girl. Call it a day, little girl.
WGN Radio, I'm Robert James, and yeah, there it is. Everybody's redone it from The Happenings to Donny Osmond, but in 1962 on Columbia, Steve Lawrence made it a smash. And we're playing some Steve Lawrence, and I'll get some Stephen Eady, too, because, of course, the news of his death at 88. Though I sheepishly admit, when John told me that this morning, I said, gee, I thought he was dead. But no, he wasn't, but he has had Alzheimer's. So we're talking D.B. Cooper and suspects and things like that. And as I mentioned, there is the parachute that suddenly the museum that was going to allow the investigator to take samples and a close look. Tom Kay is that investigator, was going to take several samples. And suddenly they're, nope, can't do that. So the thought is, well, the FBI is back in action. But that's a conjecture. But that's not the only thing that that Tom Kay and our buddy Ullis, who I forget his first name right now, but he's like the Eric Ullis, talking about this. They're very interested in the gift that keeps on giving, the clip-on tie, which was left on the seat when Dan Cooper made his jump. And what happened there was that Tom Kay, and they allowed him, actually, the FBI allowed him, before the FBI closed the case, they allowed Tom Kay to take several sticky stub samples of the tie. And it was then sent to Macrone Associates in Chicago and was scanned with an electron microscope. And the samples were interesting because there were so many of them, and several thousand pure titanium particles, as well as rare earth elements. And there's a list of them online if you ever want to see it. But that starts to lead you to believe that whoever Dan Cooper was had to be someone with access to this type of situation, because the particles obviously were transferred to the tie, and you and I and the guy next door wouldn't come into contact on that. Well, there's two possibilities with this, and one of them is a titanium research engineer who worked at a metals factory in Pittsburgh, and that's Vince Peterson. who would have been 52 at the time. Vince died a while ago, and he continues to be a suspect, though many times, you know, you're hearing people saying, you're not as compelling as I'd like. And so the next one that came up that positively is compelling is Milton Vordal. Now, Milton Vordal, again, is another Pittsburgh connection, and it is another case of someone who is no longer with us. But Vordal was absolutely an interesting guy. And, oh yeah, we have time to talk about him. So here is the deal with him. He was a guy, his parents were Norwegian immigrants, and he, in high school, he was a marksman, and he was a basic science nerd and all that kind of stuff. He worked at DuPont when World War II started, and they went to work for Remington Arms and had multiple patents involving explosives, also a patent for a 30-06 rifle cartridge and more. That's not the patent you're going to be interested in, though. He was recruited to work on the Manhattan Project in 1943. He was there for 3 years. He worked in Hanford developing the Fat Man bomb that would be dropped, obviously, on Nagasaki, and all of that. Following the war, he moved back to the East Coast, worked for Crucible Steel outside of Pittsburgh. And his name, over the next 20 years, appeared on more titanium patents than any other employee, which was interesting. But one of the particles was very interesting because it turns out that there were only two patents for it. One, it's a TSIB alloy, where it appears only twice in the entire decade of the 60s for any use or any patent. One is from a Massachusetts electronics company that was trying to put it into a transistor, which didn't work out too well. But the other was, in fact, Milton Vordal, who holds the patent, a 1965 patent. He, by the way, also determined it was inefficient and never commercially viable, but he maintained the patent. And it absolutely matches some of the things that are on this tie. So Vordal is a very interesting suspect as far as that goes. He was a consultant in the late 60s for Boeing's SST project. And that was going to be, you know, our answer to the Concorde. And that, of course, U.S. government subsidized it at first, but then, of course, it was not going to be happen. Summer 61, Congress pulled the plug. So with the SST project being canceled, there are many people who said, well, you know, it would probably be, might be emotional about that. And he was actually at the time living in Henderson, Nevada. And here's the one that got me. Okay, so the SST project is shut down. He loses his job along with about 450 people. The plant manager in charge of the laboratory where he worked was Don Cooper. Close enough. Yeah, ding, ding, ding. We might have a winner. Who knows? He, like I say, his granddaughter, as we speak, was on a podcast, and she was as surprised as the rest of the class about him. There were other new suspects as well, in addition to Vince Peterson and Milton Vordal, who maybe are the leading two at this moment, and that would be Jason Langseth and Fred Catalano. And, you know, he was one that no one had even heard the name. And but he came to the FBI's attention around 1972 and was a suspect for a number of years. He bears a striking resemblance to the sketch of who D.B. Cooper was. At the time of the hijacking, he was a purser at TWA, cycled through a number of other jobs relatively quickly. And he left TWA actually in 74, filed several lawsuits. But he was missing from work the week of the hijacking. And he was temporarily fleeing the country, it was said. In 1999, he was arrested for tampering with evidence. I don't know if that involves the D.B. Cooper thing. But many people say Catalano is the best subject the FBI was ever investigating. But I think Vordal is pretty darn good, too. All right, a couple other things, I'm sure, but we can get into them as we get into your calls, which we will coming up on WGN Radio.
I don't wanna go.
just wanna stay here and love you.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Now that I can be alone with you,
I won't throw away the chance. There's no place like home with you, so I wanna stay here and love you. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
WGN Radio. I'm Riley James. 1963. Our man Steve and Edie were living the big life. And I want to stay here on Columbia was proof of it. 888-876-5593. So rest in peace, Steve Lawrence. 88. Dead Alzheimer's. John is in Oak Lawn. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hey, Riley, good evening.
Glad you
just 727 mechanic for years.
Yeah.
And talking about them aft air stairs.
Yeah.
Served a dual purpose. And one of the purposes was when you lowered them because of the three big engines in the back, it would keep the plane from tipping on its tail in the hangar. Sometimes it would stand up.
I love that. I love that. Makes
and
sense.
And yes, you could exit and enter the aircraft as mechanics that we were. We did all the time. But
sure.
After the Cooper thing, they modified the airplane with this little wind vane outside that when the aircraft had the airstream going over it, it would turn that vane to a little bar that would keep that air stair from coming down.
Interesting.
In flight.
Interesting.
Spring-loaded. And then when the aircraft would land, spring-loaded thing would turn and open it,
yeah.
You could lower the stairs.
Right, right, because they were very useful.
And we called it the DB Cooper valve.
Right, absolutely. I'm sure that was it. Because, as I say, some of that heavy iron after World War II, a lot of those planes had those aft stairs. And I always thought it was interesting in the 727 because of the three engines in the rear. I thought, a little bit noisy there.
And you know what, Riley? That airplane, if the fuel load was low in the front,
yeah,
you weren't careful, it would stand up. It would bang the tail off the ground.
Oh, yeah.
The hangar in maintenance.
I believe that. There were a number of things. I remember when they first came out, which I think was about 62 when they first came out. There were a few of them that went down because there were hairline fractures in the tail that they didn't notice, and then it would take off again. Of course, that'd be all she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, of course, is for pilots who had never, been using, as far as captain seat on a 7-2, it's a little different. I know a number of people who were close to scraping that tail on takeoff.
Yeah, they got a tail skid back there for that reason.
Yes.
And we would inspect that skid and we could tell if the pilots hit the ground taking off.
Exactly.
Yeah,
no,
and
I mean
that would protect the rear end of the aircraft, yes.
That was a problem, and I think that led to the hairline fractures that they had at first, and they somehow fixed that. It was also interesting when they finally deployed that in South America and places like La Paz on the Altiplano. The runways were never going to allow that to, you could land, you just wouldn't take off again, so they had to really retro it to sell them there. Oh, fascinating.
That was a good airplane, and it was, but it was a fuel hog, and, they had to get them down,
Well, right, it was, but now figure this, it was not a fuel hog compared to the 707.
Right, right.
That was insane. You're right, they did.
Like smoke and all.
Yeah. So were you working out of Seattle?
No, Midway Airport.
Oh, okay, all right. All right.
I'm well, from the Midway area. I did 40 years there working on helicopters, jets, everything, and
neat.
Yeah, whole career there.
Yeah, well, it's nice to think about maintenance being done here. So much of it is offshore now. It scares the hell out of me.
As it does us, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny they when...
outsource a lot of stuff.
When all the stuff was going on about all the Clinton conspiracies and all, of course, the MENA airport was one of them. So I got in my car and I drove to the MENA airport, you know, because they said, well, that's where they're doing maintenance. And it was the strangest situation. For one thing, it said there was absolutely no trespassing at the airport. And they talked about the fine for the first offense. They spelled offense like it was a British word. And then I looked around and I said, now, this is very interesting. You can easily land heavy iron, but there's absolutely no manned tower. This is just a priceless little setup, and I didn't see any maintenance.
Yeah, well, it's out there, Raleigh. You know, we did the best we could, and the safety record shows it.
Yes.
On American Airlines or U.S. Airlines.
Oh, absolutely. You know, anybody who doubts that, you know, you look at the numbers and anything else would pale by comparison. You're probably safer on that plane than walking to the bathroom.
Yes, if I can get a shout out to all the A&P mechanics out there doing their job tonight, you know.
Absolutely. I hope some are listening, and I wish some would call me. When I worked in Philadelphia, I used to have a lot of people at the Philly airport call me, so that'd be fun.
Yeah. Raleigh, can I ask you one question?
Sure.
There is a song from like 1971 called Resurrection Shuffle.
Yeah.
Ashton, Gardner, and Dyke.
Yeah. What about
whatever happened to it? Yeah, nobody ever, I never heard it again since I was a kid.
Let me see if it's on this computer.
I wonder if that's a cool beat to it could lead into different segments of a radio show,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've got it on this computer and from 1971, and I will play it after the next commercial break. Gardner and Dyke Ashton. Yeah, I sure will. You'll hear it.
Thank you, dear. I appreciate
that. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Raleigh, talk to you soon.
Okay, I hope so. Thanks. 888-876-5593. Gardner and Dyke Ashton coming up on WGN Radio. James, and that's for John in Oakland, and that is, yes, Ashton, Gardner, and Dyke. Yeah, it was not much of a hit here. It got number 40 on the pop charts in 1961. It was released in 1960 stateside on Capitol. And they were a trio from England. That'd be Tony Ashton and Kim Gardner and Roy Dyke. And I think at least two out of three are no longer with us. Ashton and Gardner both died, about 20 years ago now. All right, so I don't know about Dyke. 888-876-5593. 8888 Raleigh. And let's see what we have going on here. Ah, I don't know if he's still with us because it's been a long time, but Jimmy P was on the South Side. Are you still with us, Jimmy P?
Hey, Raleigh, how you doing?
Thanks for waiting.
Hey, for you, I do it. You know, you do a lot of things for me. So.
It's very kind.
Listen, I called. I wanted to talk about proprioception, but when I called, I heard about Steve Lawrence. I followed him and Steve and Edie on the old Steve Allen when he edited the Tonight Show.
Yes, that's 50s. Right. You're absolutely right.
He found Steve and Edie, Andy Williams, and he had a great show.
Yes.
But anyway, that's a lot of memories over there. But I called. I wanted to ask you. I've noticed the last few days people calling up with different ailments, and you seem to talk about layman's language. What do you know about proprioception?
Almost nothing. What? Tell me more about it.
Well, you know, I was hurt. I was paralyzed, and I got the operation. I got my walking back like a miracle doctor. But this proprioception, no balance whatsoever.
Right. They used to call it kinesthesia, I think.
Is there any relation to the injury a while ago to this proprioception? How do you get it? I mean, you know, how did I happen to get it?
Well, it's basically a nervous situation. The nerves in your body, it's sensory receptors in your muscles, but they're also in your joints and your tendons. And the receptors are supposed to send messages to your brain about your position and your action. And then the brain, of course, processes them and then works with your vision and the vestibular system. And you have the perception of where your body's going, how you're moving, and all that. But what happens when you have this is that you can be falling when you're walking across uneven surfaces. You can underestimate or overestimate your strength. You don't necessarily know how much force to use when picking up a pencil or picking up a brick. You know, there can be a coordination problem. There can be balance issues. But in terms of what can do it, well, strokes certainly can. And things like MS can, ALS can, some Parkinson's could or Huntington's could, herniated discs could, peripheral neuropathy, you know. But the reality is I could go on and on, and they don't know. If you had any recent surgery that could affect it, you know, whenever you first had symptoms.
Yeah, I had a lot of, I'm in great health aside from the... you know, the back problems. Everything else is good except the balance and everything. I seem to have lost it. I exercise. I do the bike. I ride a bike an hour every other day. Mm-hmm. And I'm straightening my legs, but
Stuff that they use is like not necessarily a TENS unit, but like somatosensory stimulation, the little electrical stimulation. Tai Chi as far as that. There's also physical therapy for it. Because the big thing, and you're already on it for this, is you want to make sure you don't have muscle deterioration.
I went through that. I had to bring my muscles back when I was paralyzed.
Right.
I was like they called John the Miracle Man. Well, they called me the Miracle Guy. I was never supposed to walk, and I'm walking, but now I don't have any balance.
Well, I think what's going on is that it's probably more in your brain that the messages that the neural is supposed to give to the brain isn't firing right. Now, one of the reasons that physical therapy, just like for stroke people, is so helpful because the brain can rewire itself, and so if you exercise in a way repetitively, the brain can make a new neural pathway so it understands.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying.
But, you know, you and John have the same thing because you're having trouble moving. You have to actually think before you take a step. Nothing comes natural.
Yeah,
nothing
yeah.
comes natural. And, you know, how long ago did you really manifest this?
Oh, I'd say about 3 years ago.
All right. Well, that's still relatively recent. Keep up with the therapy because as much as possible, what you're trying to do right now, I think more than anything, because you got your muscles back, is you're trying to rewire your brain.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, well, it's not only frustrating, it's tiring because people don't think about it. You know, if somebody else wants to have dinner, they pick up a fork and put it to their mouth without ever thinking about it. You can't do that. You have to think about it.
Absolutely.
Like I say, it used to be called kinesthesia. I don't know if it still is, but in terms of, you know, anything other than repetitive motion to try and rewire the brain, like I say, I know absolutely nothing.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd give it...
No, I'm
glad, I just want to hear you talk about it as opposed to the doctors. Doctors don't say much, you know. Well, keep it, go to therapy, and which I'm doing.
Yeah, no. Well, I think you can rewire the brain, and, you know, the more you do things repetitively, especially the treadmill's great, the walking is great, and, you know,
yeah,
when you
I
walk...
I love it. I was always athletic. I always ran, and, you know, 3 miles a day. And,
yeah, no,
and
that...
And the mental aspect of not being able to, it's tough.
It is tough, and it's just so fatiguing, like I say, to be thinking in terms of heel down, then toe down, move foot. You know, I mean, people don't understand what they take for granted. And, of course, children learn early, but, you know, when you're 2 years old, a year seems like it's a decade. For us, time moves very quickly. And so the rewiring takes literally years. But if you've got a good physical therapist, that's your biggest ally.
Yeah.
And also occupational therapy, that can do a lot too.
Yeah, I'm doing it. I'm trying. I'm keeping as active as I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Riley, it's always a pleasure.
Likewise.
And I keep on helping these people that call, you know.
Absolutely.
You're a friend of those who need a friend, like I said.
It's always great to hear from you. Thank you, Jimmy.
All right, I'll talk to you later, Riley.
Goodbye. Appreciate it. 888-876-5593 is 8888 Raleigh. And I can't remember if I did or I didn't, so I will now in case I didn't, and we'll be back on WGN Radio.
My friends think I'm an awful bore ever since I fell in love with you. Surface yet. Somehow I can't stop talking about you. Can't stop saying I love you. Can't stop telling the world you're mine.
I can't stand all this growing. There's nothing I can do.
My heart just keeps overflowing with new things to say about you.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. And of course, that's Steve and Edie, 1963 on Columbia. Yeah, they really were on top of the world back then. All those Las Vegas appearances and everything else. So, I forgot a suspect, one of the more recent suspects in D.B. Cooper. So, I'll close with this unless you want to open it with other comments, and that's fine. And that's William J. Smith. And it was actually an Army analyst who wrote to the FBI 2 years after they supposedly closed the case in November of 2018. And he said, I got somebody who, in my professional opinion, there's just too many connections to be simply a coincidence. Smith was a World War II veteran. He had combat aircrew training. Following his discharge, he worked for Lehigh Valley Railroad and was affected by the Penn Central strike, well, the bankruptcy, actually, in 1970, which was the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history at the time. If you're long of tooth like I am, you'll remember that Penn Central bankruptcy. And what's interesting to the Army analyst was that D.B. Cooper, it was known, had told the air hostess that he had a grudge while he was on the airplane and that his motive to carry out the hijacking was pretty much against the corporate world and the transportation industry. And so the FBI had that in their notes that that was plausible, and the analyst found that and said, well, the interesting thing was that not only was he with Penn Central and Lehigh Valley Railroad, the aluminum spiral chips found on the clip-on tie left behind could have come from a locomotive maintenance facility where Smith had worked. Also, his picture on the Lehigh Valley Railroad website showed a remarkable resemblance to Cooper's FBI sketches. And on top of that, his pension was threatened by the collapse of Penn Central. So $200,000 ransom money might have been to secure his future. We're not going to know because Smith died in 2018, actually conveniently just before the Army analyst passed his name along, 89 years old. So you got a lot to choose from, and I'll leave it to you. I didn't mention much about Jason Lanthseth. He's one of the new ones. But I think, yeah, Vince Peterson and Milton Vordal. I'm going with Milton right now, but that's we'll conclude it unless you've got more to say. So 888-876-5593. And Elizabeth is in Rock Falls. So Elizabeth, thanks for waiting. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hi, Raleigh.
How's Mr. Chubbs?
I was waiting for that.
Well, you knew it. Yes, every time I see your name on the screen, I think, oh, Mr. Chubbs.
I wish you could see him.
Well, send us a picture. I'll put it on the web.
How do I get it to you?
Email it.
Oh, okay. I'll try that.
Okay.
I'm curious to see what he'll do with the time change this weekend.
Will he
we
know?
Changed time.
Yeah, right. Will he know?
Well, he's on such a rigid schedule. I mean, he's on the dot of when we're supposed to do things.
Really?
And when we changed last spring, he changed right along with it. There was no problem, but I don't know what's going to happen this time.
Well, if it happened before, probably the same thing.
I don't know how that happens. I mean, how would a dog know time has changed?
I would assume he only knows by your intentions.
Maybe so.
You know, because if you weren't creating the schedule, I'd say, well, it's the phase of the moon, so he'll, or whatever, you know, the position of the sun, I don't know, whatever it is. But in this case, you're creating the schedule. So
No, he did it.
Oh, he did it. Oh, he created the schedule and you went along with this. So in other words, Mr. Chubb owns you. All right.
He tells you exactly what to do at whatever time.
I see. So Mr. Chubb is the alpha in this group. Well, that's going to be interesting. Well,
pretty quickly, actually.
But if he is controlling the schedule, then he should, I would assume, continue with whatever he was doing because the time construct is artificial.
Okay. Well, let me know.
I can't wait to hear about this. But, you know, at some point, you're going to have to assert your dominance here or Mr. Chubbs is going to win.
He already has.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, so I shouldn't ask if he's losing weight then.
A little bit at a time.
Good.
But his hair is growing longer and longer. His hair is 4 inches long now.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, he must be beautiful.
He is. He has so many colors. He's just having a gorgeous coat.
You brush that hair regularly, don't you?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
Good. So no knots or any of all that. So that's great.
It doesn't mat really. It's just really silky.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, he's obviously living in style.
I heard Jimmy P, is that who it was, talking about his balance problem?
Yes.
Well, I know this has nothing to do with that, but it reminded me of my husband. He had very drastic surgery in 2008.
Uh-huh.
And a few weeks later, he had trouble walking. He just couldn't pick up his feet and move. And if he came to a change in textures, like from carpet to wood, he had to stop and think about how to get over that bridge.
That sounds just like kinesthesia.
Well, he went to a neurologist, and he said, I think you have glue foot. And he said,
glue foot.
I want you to walk down the hallway for me. And he watched him, and he said, I think we can take care of that. And he said, I'm going to do a test. I'm going to withdraw some spinal fluid and then watch you walk again. And so he did that. And Glenn got up off the table and just walked like nothing down the hall.
Wow.
So it turned out he had a form of hydrocephalus in his 70s.
Oh, wow.
And so the neurosurgeon put a drain from his brain down through his neck that went all the way down into the abdominal cavity.
Wow.
And there was a sensor, a metal sensor on the top of his head that they could regulate with a magnet.
Oh my
it was
God.
Under the scalp.
Yeah.
Under the scalp. But whenever he'd go to a store, he'd set off the alarm.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, he'd be great at the airport.
So anyway, it really fixed it.
Wow.
And it's just such an odd thing that not many people think about, but it sure, was so thankful. And I remember the morning right after surgery, the doctor stood in the doorway and he said, okay, get up and come to me. And he got out of bed and walked right over.
Wow.
And he just kept walking really well.
That's terrific. Well, hydrocephalus usually, it's that you have fluid in the ventricles, and that's tough for a lot of things.
He had a problem all his life until then. I don't know how it occurred suddenly like that, but.
Yeah, right, because normally you see it in infants. That's where you see the huge head and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But you don't normally see somebody who's, several decades old. Wow.
It has a special name, but I can't think of it.
Wow.
But what I was going to talk to you about was WSBR. Remember Daryl WSBR?
Yes.
Well, they always had their station in the basement of the Lawrence building. And they gave out really good weather reports. If we were having a storm, they would tell us, go to your basement, do whatever. Well, then they moved to a building of their own out north of Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
And one night there was a really bad storm. So we were in the basement listening to the radio. And he was telling us, what the winds were going to be. And all of a sudden he said, I'm looking out the window. It looks really bad. I'm getting out of here.
Oh, no.
He cut everything off and left. Oh, no.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
We looked at each other like, what in the world? He just left.
That's hilarious. Well, I can understand it. There was a radio station I worked at in Jeffersonville, Indiana, outside of Louisville. And it was a little AM, and they actually told us, tornado weather's coming. If you hear any alarms, leave the building.
Oh.
Now, the problem with this is what? And stand in the way of the towers? What do you mean, leave the building? There were, what? And take solace behind the nearest tree? I couldn't imagine. So small market radio is just resplendent with those kind of stories.
So, it was like 9 o'clock at night, and away he went.
Well, I can't really blame him. I guess he had some place to go. Too bad they left the basement.
They didn't have a basement there.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's what I mean. Too bad they moved.
Right.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's perfect. Just perfect.
But it was a good little, it was a good little station. It's different now.
12:40 a.m., just like one of mine, which is nice. But yeah, nothing's like it was.
Did you watch that video, Raleigh?
I know you sent me that, and I haven't yet. I've still got that in my awaiting response pile, and it's on the list. And, maybe after I'm done fighting permits, I did finally get the contract with one of my cell tenants, at one of my sites, so that worked out. So now I fight permits.
Oh, Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
What does that mean? You have to have a permit?
Well, no, here's the thing. All I'm doing is adding a Connex box for storage to one of my sites. And they won't let me add it until I get it permitted. Well, you know, they've made Connex boxes forever. They travel from China to here. They have every kind of weather in the world. What the hell do they think is going to happen to this Connex box? But nonetheless, I have to have engineering studies. I have to have electrical one lines on and on. I'm just going to put some power in it. On and on and on. So the last time I did this in 2019, I didn't get the permits till 2020. So we'll see this time. I'm really frosted because I finally put the permit application in, and they immediately came back to me and said, well, the engineering letter doesn't state this and that. Now, by the way, I sent them the engineering letter over a month ago to look over, see if I need anything. Never a word. So now, out of the blue, it's, you know, and so I wrote back and I said, you know, I don't understand, you know, why you need, you know, whatever the two things were. And so in her answer to me, I couldn't believe it. She has a parenthetical phrase about I also need, like a throwaway line. I'm like, that's all brand new. So, you know, you wonder why people conduct work without, you know, kind of skirting the regulations. And it's like, I guess I'm the jumpier.
Oh, it's frustrating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it takes, like I say, it took a year last time. It's only been 4 months this time so far.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll be quicker.
Yes, we'll see. We'll absolutely see. All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
We'll see what happens with Chubbs Sunday night, Monday.
Give him a, let me know. I want to know. He'll be interesting, and give him a big hug for me.
Okay, I will.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah, I don't even know him, and I just love Mr. Chubbs. All right, so it is time. The time has come. Oh, I'm sure he's in his glory and splendor, given that this is, in fact, the State of the Union Day. Maybe there'll be a mention of that. I don't know. He recorded it before that, however. But, of course, I'm talking about the wonderful Walter. That's right. It is time for Walter's Perspective, sponsored by HearingHealthCenter.com. WGN Radio. I'm Robbie James. All right, so the lovely and talented Johnny D has been pleading for Bonnie Raitt, and Runaway, it was the highest chart record she had. How bad could it be? Well, I just found out. So no more Bonnie Raitt. Don't even ask Johnny D, but we're glad to have you listening. 1977 on Warner Brothers. Maybe you liked it. Not many people did. It only got to number 51 nationally. All right, so finally, I'm in the majority. I don't like it either. 888-876-5593. We'll get to Leah and Marcus Hook, Steve and Edie, Eduardo in Tampa, Strawberry Festival, indeed, Cleveland Dennis, Connex boxes. Dave and LaSalle has a request, and Ruth and Gurney, if she's still awake, wants to talk about Girl Scouts. Attendance will be taken on WGN Radio.
Every little bit hurts. Every little bit hurts. Every night I sigh, every night I wonder why you treat me so, yet you won't let me go. Every little hurt counts, every little hurt counts. You say you're coming home, yet you never phone, leave me all alone. My love is strong for you. So loneliness you give me, yeah. I can't
I'm Ronnie James. And no, that is not Brenda Holloway. That's the demo. And that's Barbara Wilson, who at the time was Frank Wilson's wife, a writer for Motown. And Stephanie and Madison wanted us to play the Brenda Holloway version. I'd be happy to do that, but I thought that maybe she hadn't heard Barbara Wilson doing it. So that was the demo that they took to Brenda Holloway and said, that's what we want. And it was interesting because Brenda actually has a lot of distinctions, but probably the biggest is she was the first Motown West Coast hit artists. Yeah, as far as things recorded in Los Angeles on the West Coast, that was Brenda. And actually, that also came out on Donna, which was the same label that Richie Valens and all that had been on, early Keen, Bob Keen's label is one of those. So anyway, I'll get to Brenda as well, but I thought you might want to hear Barbara. 888-876-5593, 8888 Raleigh. Eduardo is in Tampa. Are you still with us, Eduardo?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, today was pretty interesting. I woke up just as you were going to start your show. How about that?
Good. Good for you. A nice day of sleep.
Yeah. That's like this. That's happened like on multiple times. It's like, hey, it's time for the Raleigh James Show. So wake up.
Well, very, very glad to have you. That's great. All right.
Yeah, so I'll be up for a while. But, yeah, I went to the Strawberry Festival in Plant City. And I yeah, I always... A little bit suspect because I don't want to feel like I'm at a carnival or your neighborhood carnival here, but, you know, they had the vendors in the back, and I got to try out some of the, you create your own strawberry pie.
Yeah.
It was $6. It was good, and me and Mom got some cookies and some, looks like a pound cake or something like that.
Neat.
Made out of strawberry, so that was pretty neat.
Yeah, it is, and that's every spring. It's been going on for years. It's like 10 days or so that they have this. So now through probably through the weekend.
Yeah,
and it makes sense because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, Tampa's in Hillsborough County, and Hillsborough County has like almost 3,000 farms. So there is a lot of agriculture that people don't realize, and of course the Strawberry Festival highlights a lot of that. So that's neat.
Yeah, that was pretty neat to do that. I next year I got to go because I missed the. I know they had the at the fairgrounds. They had the state fair. I got to check that out next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they have a lot of stuff there.
Although I'll tell you, I miss the fairs that had the midways, you know, the politically incorrect midways with, you know, the fat lady and the, you know, three-legged whatever, all that. And I really miss all the freak shows.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw it when they were doing the fairgrounds because I saw this on the TV. Uh-huh. They were doing the throwing the axe and walking on the logs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but not like, she's live. One-tenth of a dollar, step right up. Yeah, God knows what you'd see. Yeah, but it's still fun. So, Plant City's like at the edge of Hillsborough County there. You're halfway to Lakeland on that on I-4.
I saw and I saw the Amtrak on the way back.
Yeah, but that's great. So did you go yourself? Did you bring your mom? What was the deal?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. And we always carry, when I always step out, when we go on the car, I always have because she can't walk that much, like on long walks, just on short walks, but we have the wheelchair, we always take that with us in the car.
Very good.
So that's good. Although it's a little bit hard to do that when it's not cement and you're doing it on the grass. It's a little...
Oh, yeah, that is very tough.
So that works better if you have, because some of the people I saw were there, they had the scooters, the motorized scooters.
Right, the motorized scooters. Are more. Even some of the walkers are better. I don't know how a rollator would do on it, but a standard walker might be all right.
Yeah. Yeah, but there was areas where there was cement and you can just, you know, I mean, a good thing is just walking along there on the cement.
Yeah. Well, neat. But
it was a nice experience.
They've got a historical museum in Plant City, too, I know.
Yeah. I couldn't believe, because it was Thursday today, I figured, oh, my God, there's probably not going to be a lot of people, but it was a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you are in the state of retirees, so what does it matter if it's Thursday?
Oh, yeah, they're not doing the 9 to 5.
Exactly.
Yeah, that explains that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, you're in the state where the state bird is the early bird.
Yeah, but it was a good experience. So it was good to see people out there, and they took their families out there. So
great.
Yeah, good experience here. Hey, before I go, I was going to mention, I saw this in the Times here, sports referees. I don't know if you ever talked about that, but, I mean, it's good to see people get out there and have their sons and daughters play sports and instead of being on the social media. But they do get out of hand sometimes. I mean, it can get very competitive, and referees don't last that long.
Well, absolutely. I remember when I was in Idaho, they were getting arrested. You know, one thing to have physical fights, but I mean, they were throwing racial slurs at each other. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Uh-oh. And you're saying, wait a minute, you know, it's football or whatever. So yeah. It is interesting how, especially when some of those refs are the parents of a team player, you know, I mean, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the 50,000 referees they lost in the last 3 years, and over here they got 8,000. They're down like 400.
Well, these aren't only school referees. These are all sorts of sports that you're looking at, and yeah, it's interesting because if you look at the job boards and all that, they're always offering referee jobs. But yeah, you're right. It probably has a limited life cycle.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the parents they do they definitely spend quite a bit. It says they spend like $883 per child.
Oh, I'm sure. That, you know, that would include the uniform or whatever and everything else. Sure.
Traveling expenses, $10,000 a season. So.
Yeah, that's tough.
You definitely got a budget for this.
Well, sure. Absolutely. And decide if it's worth it to you. So, yeah.
Well, better than being on the computer screen. I think it's great that we can see more kids being
outside, being more involved in sports. Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I know they've got like a national association, everything does, of sports officials and stuff. So there's probably more information there because, you know, referees and umps and judges and assigners and all that, it's all part of the NASO, the National Association of Sports Officials. So you too can become an official, whether it's baseball or basketball or football or lacrosse or soccer, softball, stunt, tennis, or volleyball. What the hell is stunt? All right, I'm looking it up.
Stunt.
How to become a stunt official. All right.
Stunt official.
Yeah, ever heard of that?
Like in the Evel Knievel type of stunt?
I'm not sure. I'm first trying to get out of the cookies here. I'll look at the website, but apparently they want me to agree to all of them. Well, that's not going to be happening, but oh, I don't care. All right, so stunt. Stunt officials are required to attend training and development every year. You will have to learn, you'll have to learn what the sport is. The rules for the game you are officiating, including scoring and game format. You will need to watch and be familiar with routines being performed and use provided 8-count sheet to determine which team scores. Club, high school, and college games utilize different routines, so most officials tend to officiate one level during a season. You must also pass an online scoring exam. You must have a short-sleeved white polo shirt. You must have a black professional or athletic pants. Leggings are not allowed. You must have a whistle, footwear that is not potentially damaging to the field, and ideally an iPhone with AirPods. Estimated cost, $100 to $200. You are required to join a local organization. There may be additional... What do you do? As the sport of stunt grows and evolves, so do the stunt procedures. I've never heard of this. All right, so let me look at it somewhere else. What could it be? I mean, they're saying it's a team sport. One of the fastest growing female sports, they say. All right, what are the ladies going to do, the gals going to do? Incorporate skills derived from cheerleading. It's an exciting head-to-head game between two teams who execute skills-based routines in various categories. Partner stunts, jumps and tumbling, pyramids and tosses, and team routines. Alrighty then, so stunt is a sport. Well, since there is Title IX, I think they have to have a guy stunt team too, don't you think? Could be very.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like cheerleading to me. Yeah.
Yeah, well, if it's Title IX compliant, you need, and they say it's for females. They need guys. Let's have a guys team doing this. All right. So apparently, stunt is a thing. One of the fastest growing female sports in the country. All righty then.
Yeah, maybe we'll see that in the Paris Olympics.
I don't think so. But, you know, who knows? There are over 500,000 high school cheerleaders, so stunt expands participation opportunities, providing an avenue for... They keep saying young women and female, but I would think that with Title IX, it could be guys, too. Well, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they have both. You see them there on the sidelines. Yeah.
You would think so. With four quarters of play, partner stunts, pyramids and tosses, jumps and tumbling, and team routine, it's an exciting sport to coach or watch or play. If you say so, I'm tired reading it. And they have a video. They have a video,
and
too.
Active outside. Yeah. I'm for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, all right. I'll learn something new every day. All right. I never heard of it.
Yep.
All right. Good deal.
All right. I'll let you get on to
Thanks
some
for
more
calling.
Calls here.
Appreciate it.
All right.
It.
Have a good weekend, everyone.
You too. And when you ask me, how do you know so many things? Well, it's because I stumble across them like this. Stunt. All right. Get down with your bad self. All this and more coming up on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Robbie James. Well, Fran wanted to hear that. You never have to twist my arm to play the Marvelettes. Love them. Strange, I know. Indeed. 888-876-5593 would be 8888. Raleigh and Dave in LaSalle has requests if he's still with us. You still there, Dave?
Yeah, I'm here, Raleigh.
Well, thanks for waiting. What you want to hear?
A song called Cry to Me by Solomon.
Of course. Big hit.
Yeah, I always liked it. I keep wanting to say cry, 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 because it's Cry to Me.
Right, yeah, Cry to Me, yes, Solomon Burke.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
So whenever you could fit that in
I'll
there,
play it for you next.
I love it.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Okay. Appreciate it.
Have a good one. Bye.
Yeah, you. Let's see. So, yeah, Solomon Burke, that's as Philadelphia as it gets. And, of course, he's as soulful and gospely as it gets, comes from a long line of that. Leah is in Marcus Hook, speaking to the Philadelphia area. What's happening tonight, Leah?
Hi, Raleigh. How are you? How did it go at the dentist?
You know, remarkably well. They didn't make any horrible errors. They got the temporary off fine. The only thing was when they were prepping originally for the crown, they had exposed some nerve. And so consequently, there was some nerve pain involved in getting off the temporary and putting on the permanent and all that. So, yeah, it was a bit of nerve pain. But other than that, and then filing it so I actually could close my mouth was, you know, relatively pain-free other than that, and trouble-free, so no complaints.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Well, I'm glad.
Yeah.
I want to talk. I hope Elizabeth sends you that picture of
Me
Mr.
Too.
Chubbs so
I
you
want,
can put
I,
it on.
Yeah, I want to see Mr. Chubbs.
I've been dying to see a picture of Mr.
Yeah,
Chubbs.
Yeah.
She talks about him so much, and I can't wait to see a picture of him.
Me too.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about Stephen Eadie. It's funny, I mean, it's weird, not funny, but it's weird that he died now, because they just had, like, 2 or 3 days ago, they just had a documentary on PBS of Stephen Eadie, and it was done by his son, their son, and produced and narrated by him and everything. And I mean, Eadie Gourmet had an unbelievable voice. Mm-hmm. She was unbelievable. She was a real belter. She could really belt out a song. And they were talking about once when she beat out, I forget what year it was, but she beat out Barbara Streisand for the Grammy and something, I don't know, in some category.
Interesting.
I think it was. I don't know. They played the song, and I can't remember what song it was. It was just amazing. What a voice. What a voice. They were amazing. It's a really good documentary, and so people should look for it on PBS.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure the timing was not that unusual, because, of course, Steve had Alzheimer's, and it was known that the end was fairly near.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah. So,
maybe. But yeah, Eadie died in 2013.
Right. And she was 7 or 8 years older than them, because she was born in 28.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when you talk about, for instance, her against, say, a Barbara Streisand, well, they're absolutely different generations, you know, as far as that goes. I know in 64, Barbara, I think, won that Barbara Streisand album. She was against Blame It on the Bossa Nova for Eadie, and Peggy Lee, I'm a Woman, and, you know, all that. So I don't know. Eadie, well, I guess Eadie won in 67 for If You Walk Into My Life Today, and Barbara Streisand was up for Color Me Barbara. And then,
maybe that's what it was.
Right, by the way, Nancy Sinatra, that year was up, These Boots Are Made for Walking. Yeah, so Sandy Posey, Born a Woman, and Ella Fitzgerald had an album out. So that was the nominees, the four nominees, and then Eadie won that in 67. So, yeah.
Yeah. She was amazing. Well, they were both amazing. I used to love watching them on The Tonight Show, and they used to have specials on all the time. They didn't have their own show, though, did they?
Well, actually, for a while, they had The Tonight Show when, after Steve Allen left. Hang on a minute, and I'll tell you all about it. It wasn't for that long, but yes, they did. Anyway, we'll pick it up there, and we'll talk to Cleveland Dennis and to Ruth, if she's still with us, and you too, on WGN Radio. All right, so I've just been sitting here, and absolutely sitting here, kind of in la-la land, and didn't even bother to find the Solomon Burke record, but I will, because I promised, and I will. So let's see. I'll try to do that. I hope, if I can spell Solomon. Where is it? All right, come on. There we go. All right. I should have done this moments ago. Hey, but better late than never.
When your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, or don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like crying? Well, here I am, honey, come on, you cry to me. When you're all smell of her perfume, don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like crying? Don't you feel like a cry? Come on, come on, cry to me. Oh, nothing can be said. Oh, yes, you don't ever have to walk alone, but you
talking me. Oh, yeah.
WGN Radio. I'm Riley James. Yes, yeah, Solomon Burke, 1962 on Atlantic. Burt Burns wrote that under the Cinnamon Russell. And Claus Ogerman conducted it, arranged it, and he had some interesting stuff as well. But anyway, so there you have Solomon Burke, and happy to do that. Yeah, now that I thought about it. All right. So we're talking with Leah and Marcus Hook about Steve and Edie. All right. If you remember, Steve Allen left The Tonight Show at the beginning of 1957. But
no, I wasn't alive.
Oh, well, then how the hell were you watching it? No, all right.
Well, I watched The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
All right, no, that was later. Well, all right, so here was the deal. In fact, Steve Allen is kind of responsible for Steve and Edie getting married. But anyway, while he was doing The Tonight Show, he had his own show, The Steve Allen Show, a variety show, and it was on ABC, on NBC first and then ABC. In any event, that was separate from. After he left The Tonight Show, he kept up with his, you know, once-a-week show he was doing, and Steve and Edie were regulars. Well, in the summer of 58, if you remember, well, you don't, but back then they would have vacation replacement shows, whether you wanted them or not. And okay. So it was that Steve and Edie were a vacation replacement show for the Steve Allen Show in the summer of 58. So they did have that. But they had met each other just before they were on the Tonight Show with Steve Allen, and he did a number of skits with them, and as they got closer, eventually they got married. And so you know, in fact, viewers used to say, oh, I can see there's something going on between those two and all that kind of stuff. And so when he in 58 had the summer replacement, he picked them.
Oh, okay, I see.
So it was.
But I know they had specials on, like during the 70s and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, then, you know, in the 60s, he had a syndicated version of it that Westinghouse did. And they later called that the Steve Allen Playhouse from Hollywood. And, you know, Gene Rayburn, who had been his original announcer, came with him for that. I don't think Skitch Henderson did. And actually, Rayburn might have been doing the match game by then. But Rayburn was definitely the announcer when Steve and Edie were the vacation replacement guys.
Oh, okay.
Steve Allen is, you know, was one of the most versatile guys ever. And I think he could do so many different things that he never really got his just due of being known for any one thing. But of course, like many people of his ilk, he hated rock and roll. And so just,
really?
Oh, he hated it. And he used to have a segment where he would read the lyrics. You know, I'll never forget, like Blue Moon, it's hilarious. With all the doo-wop words and you name it. So, yeah, he just absolutely hated
it. I've seen some old clips of the Steve Allen show.
Yeah.
I'm a big Jack Kerouac fan, and I've seen some old clips of Jack Kerouac on with him and playing piano and just, you know.
Well, the first host, though, absolutely, of The Tonight Show was Steve Allen. And people don't realize that what became The Tonight Show actually debuted in 53. And,
really?
They were just calling it Tonight. And, you know, that's a point when the networks weren't providing regular programming every day, every hour, and all that. So it was early in the game. And he left in 57 because I think he wanted to, you know, pursue his own show, which he had been doing, and some other things. So then they got Jack Parr. And Jack Parr hosted it until 62, and then they got Carson. And after Carson, of course, it was Leno and everybody else. But I still say, of anyone who ever did that show, Johnny Carson was made for that show.
Oh, I love Johnny Carson.
Oh,
I just love him.
Didn't want to see him off screen, but on screen, man, oh, man, I love this guy.
Oh, my God. He had perfect comedic timing.
He absolutely did. He was just wonderful. And like many people, too bad he was tortured off the air.
Yeah.
But he was great. And I recently saw, because he had an almost 30-year run. It was 29 years when he left. I think he should have stayed for 30. But he left like 6 months before the 30th show would have been. But I couldn't believe that, my God, that's now been 32 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it will be in May because he left in May of 92.
Shoot.
Yeah, I know. 32 years. Where does the time go?
Where does the time go? I feel old.
Exactly. And I liked it better before he moved to California, too. I for whatever reason, I thought he had better audiences in New York and to some extent better guests.
I don't remember a time when he wasn't in California.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Well, actually, best thing that ever happened to him was moving to California because that's when he discovered that NBC wasn't keeping the archives of the shows. Oh, man, was he mad.
Oh, really?
Oh, man, that's right. He didn't need a microphone to be heard screaming about that. And so it was. He moved to Burbank in 72. And and he found out that, so for 10 years he did it in New York, basically. But he found out that, yeah, they didn't keep the shows. Because, of course, it was expensive. You know, you're talking about 2-inch tape, videotape. It's very expensive. Well, he just had a fit. And, of course, he later negotiated and Carson Productions owned the show. So he had total control of it. But I think if he had not left for L.A., he might not have discovered that for some time.
Yeah, and now they're all out on DVD.
Well, that's, yeah, exactly. And you can preserve something cheaply, but people, videotape came about in 1955, and that was an interesting story, too, because Ampex released the machines and couldn't get the tape to work. And it was, they were going to be at the 1955 NAB, and they literally had the machines, and the tape was just not working. And it was a guy in Opelika, Alabama, J. Herbert Orr, I think was his name, and that's why Ampex wound up, the tape was in Opelika. So, they finally at the last minute. But that tape was very, very expensive. So almost nobody preserved it. They recorded over it. And so why all those wonderful shows like that little dance show that I loved in Wilmington that you saw in Philadelphia on the Channel 12 when it was in Wilmington. Mitch Thomas, man, I loved Mitch Thomas. But there's no full tape of the Mitch Thomas show, just not one. You know, I don't know if there's any full tape of Buddy Dean out of Baltimore on WJZ. I have no idea. I doubt it.
Oh, I never heard of that one.
Oh, well, you saw the movie Hairspray. That was a story of the Buddy Dean show.
Yeah.
No, Buddy Dean was terrific.
The 50s?
What?
Was that the 50s, though?
And 60s. No, it was the 60s. What ruined him was actually when it was social changes, and he wanted to have African-Americans dancing, and this is Baltimore, which, remember, is south of the Mason-Dixon line. Don't ever forget that. When he integrated it, well, people had a fit, and meaning sponsors and stuff. And so they decided the compromise was that they were going to have it be all African-American on Tuesdays and the rest of the time. And, you know, nobody was happy with any of the compromises. And so finally he just said, well, that's it, and he went back to Pine Bluff where he owned some radio stations.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I'm out of here for Arkansas. But for years, the Buddy Dean show was just, man, the best, the absolute best. And the Royalettes came to fame because they won a talent contest on the Buddy Dean show, and the prize was a contract with MGM.
Hmm. Wow. So, yeah, I missed that.
Oh, Buddy Dean was good. Well, in, before your time, but in Philadelphia, Bob Horn, of course, you know, which predates the dreaded Dick Clark, but the Bob Horn
show.
Yeah,
I've heard you talk about him. I wish I could have caught him.
he was the real deal in terms of loving the music and all that. Didn't necessarily look the part or sound the part, but the kids loved him because they knew he knew, and he was great with that music. But the Eastern Seaboard had a lot of those shows. In D.C., they had a guy named Milt Grant. And Milt Grant later went on to put on TV 20. He was on Channel 5 originally. Then put on TV 20 in D.C. And then he started buying later, I guess in the early 80s, UHF stations for ridiculous amounts of money. But and that all folded. But
we used to watch Dick Clark because he used to have on the people we wanted to see in the 70s.
Sure.
But we weren't like fans of Dick Clark, but we watched Soul Train too.
Right. Well,
and then we would watch the Midnight Special and Don Kirshner's rock concert.
Right, because they were on then. But see, earlier when we're talking black and white and not much offers, you didn't have much of that. It just didn't exist. But yeah, by the time you were watching Clark, that was an LA show.
Oh, okay. Okay. You know, but Soul Train was good too.
Oh,
we watched
yes.
A lot of
yes.
That.
Soul Train is a Chicago originally based show. Okay. Absolutely it is. Soul Train was terrific. There a lot of that, because, you know, now we're talking 70s, a lot of that did survive. So you can see some of those Soul Trains. But there used to be a show, it was originally black and white on WLAC TV5 in Nashville, called The Beat. And they wanted a color production, so they moved it to WFAA in Dallas. And it was the best R&B show ever, as far as, you know, decent production values and all that kind of stuff. And Hoss Allen used to host it. So, and I'm sure some of The Beat is on YouTube, because I know some of those tapes survived.
Didn't John produce a dance show?
Oh, yes. Dancing on Air. And,
Dancing on Air.
Dancing on Air. And it had another, I forget what it was, locally in Philadelphia, and that was nationally. And he still got the jacket. And like I told you, I was watching some of his promo reel once, and I looked, and there was this chubby girl, and I said, "Who's that?" And it turned out, now I can't even think of her name, but she's very
Kelly.
Thin. Yeah,
Kelly from
right.
Kelly and
right.
Mark.
That's right, Kelly Ripa, who now weighs about 20 pounds. But I'll tell you, she was a
she turned sideways. She disappeared.
Right. But she was a chubby teen. But
oh, I'd love to see that. I would kill to see that.
Yeah, it's probably online somewhere. I don't
probably
know.
Probably on YouTube, right?
Yeah. Probably. I don't know. Somebody probably put it there. But yeah, Dancing on Air. And
I have to check it out and see if it's on there.
Yeah. So on the USA Network. So whatever that was. So yeah. And it had a local component, too, I know, because then they had a version that was in San Francisco that Jack Armstrong did, and one in Orange County. Yeah, but that was national on USA.
Great. Yeah. I'm going to look that up.
So it's funny, because John, who is admittedly not a top 40 radio fan, never liked any of it. But I'll tell you what, those years in the 80s when he did that dance show, man, the first note of a song comes on and he knows exactly what it is.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, and I won't because, of course, by then I never listened, but he knows them all.
He knows the 80s music.
Oh, does he ever?
Yeah, it was not my era for music. I didn't like, I liked the punk music, but I didn't like the pop music.
Well, some of like in 82 and stuff, some of that stuff that was kind of quasi-electronic, you know, that they were trying for, like She Blinded Me with Science by Thomas Dolby. I loved that. And I loved Electric Avenue, Eddie Grant, you know. So
Electric Avenue wasn't bad.
Yeah. So, and some of the disco songs, like Marcia Griffiths, the Electric Boogie, which they called Electric Slide.
Oh yeah, I can't hang with disco. Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, I just, you know, well, they're still played at weddings. Let me tell you what.
Not my wedding. It won't be.
I'm sure that's right.
It won't be.
I'm sure that's right. All right. Well, thanks. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Raleigh. Okay, bye.
All right. So 888-876-5593, 8888-Raleigh. But yeah, I thought Thomas Dolby was a terrific little record. So, look at this. The guy who has had an absolute run-in, or two, or three, with Steve and Edie is Steve Bryant. So I'm so glad you called. Tell me all about it, Steve.
Oh, thank you, Raleigh. First of all, two super nice people. I went to dinner with them many, many times. Steve and Edie had a line of cookware on BBC called Gourmet Cookware. It was
of course.
A real nice tie-in.
How could it not be?
they were so much fun, and they're great. I saw them at the old Valley Forge Music Fair. He got me into VIP seating and all that good stuff with a rotating stage. Just couldn't have been two nicer people, and I'm so sorry. I mean, I guess with Alzheimer's, it was a blessing that that he's gone now. It's just a shame, but such a talent and the fastest, funniest guy I ever talked with. I mean, just fast. But the real quick story, only one artist in the history of QVC demanded to rehearse shows before we did them. It was Carol Channing.
Okay.
So I would have to go to her hotel room and we would rehearse. And every time I went to her hotel room, she and her husband and friend, where that kind of blew up later, but anyway, they were always dressed in silk pajamas. And I was in, you know, a navy blazer, you know, the the whole corporate casual thing.
Yeah.
So one time I showed up at their hotel room, and I had bought a pair of white silk pajamas to match them. I thought that would be kind of fun.
Okay.
And they would get kicked out of it.
Oh, no, your phone is dying.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. No.
Oh, oh no. Wait. No, I've got power.
Well, you got power, but you're...
Can you hear me?
Well, I hear you. I heard you say, can you hear me fine, but you digitized out before that.
Oh, okay. How about now? How about now?
Just don't move. Just whatever you're doing,
I won't move. From here.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so it was kind of funny. I'm in pajamas, and they're in, you know, corporate casual. And I left the hotel, went down to have a drink at the bar, and Steve and Edie were there because they were playing at the Valley Forge Music Fair. So I had my overcoat on.
Okay.
You know, I didn't want to advertise the fact that I was wearing
pajamas. Right, yeah.
Right. And so I sat down, and Steve said, it was really warm in the bar. I said, take your coat off, sit down, relax. So I took my coat off, and he goes, oh. So we were upstairs having a little fun. So who's the lucky girl? You know, I said, no. I was up with Carol Channing. He said, she's kind of old for you. funny as all get out. I mean, I will never live that down. Sitting at the bar in white silk pajamas with Steve and Edie.
Yeah, that's great. That's just great. Yeah. No, it's funny because, of course, to many people, they were seen as so unhip and everything that wasn't cool. But as you found out when you met them away from that image, they were as hip as it got.
Absolutely. I mean, two of the greatest people, and the cookware did very well for a while. And like everything, it had a bell shaped curve, and then eventually it bit. You know, slowed down,
right.
But no, couldn't have been nicer. And I just it was just so sad when I heard the news today, but I just wanted to share that.
I'm so glad you did. Yeah. But you know, it was about 5 years since he's been diagnosed. So I was sort of expecting this. And of course, Edie's been gone now over a decade. So,
I know,
you know, they're together again.
They are indeed. I think that, and I will believe that.
I do too. I'm so glad you called. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Raleigh.
Talk to you soon. Okay, so Steve Bryant, one of my faves. Now, let's see what we've got here. Cleveland Dennis and Elgin, welcome back to WGN Radio.
Yes, thank you. You know, you played Strange I Know. That was the first song I requested when I found your wonderful show about 5 years ago.
Well, hopefully I played it then rather than wait 5 years.
No, you played it then and we discussed it. But anyhow... I'd like to make a request. If you could play me Rocky Billy, One Hand Loose by Charlie Feathers. I would dedicate it to my dad. His birthday is Saturday. He's been long gone. Alvis Stock, March 9th.
Ah, all right. Well, I will, you know, I've got like about 30 seconds left of showtime, I think, but I will play it next week. You can bet on it.
That'll be great. I heard a Bobby Day song, Little... Turtle Dove, I thought was unbelievably great.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you about the Connex box. You might want to try calling, finding somebody in Phoenix. They're probably somebody there. They're usually old ship captains, but they'll work on behalf of the steamship line and give you a certificate stating that the box is seaworthy. If it's seaworthy, it's got to be good enough for your use.
It's not. See, that's the thing. I've got that. And it was only a one-trip container. No, they don't care that it's seaworthy. It's just crazy. Call me next week. I'll tell you some of the ridiculous facets of this.
I will do that.
All right, thanks.
And I'm going to compliment you on your great show. Thank you.
Always good to hear from you. Thank you. And apologies to Roger and LaGrange. Oh, D.B. Cooper. Call me next week. And apologies to Ruth and Gurney and Chris in Greenwood, South Carolina. But pretty much that's a wrap. I'm Raleigh James. We thank Adam for keeping us on the air and John for screening your call. But above all, as usual, I thank you for calling. Bless you for that. We'll talk to you Monday for Monday Night Trivia on WGN Radio.